Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Thursday, February 11th, 2010, and you're listening to KVOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kvoo.fm on the web, and this is Air Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre. Today, we've got a special show for you. As many people are well aware, the World Affairs Council hosted what passes in this country for a debate between Howard Dean and Karl Rove. It would have been wonderful if it had been a true debate, but what these things generally are question and answer programs. The real debate was going on the street outside. You'll first hear some clips of the protest that was actively in progress from early in the evening and right up until the last minute when the two stars went on stage. Maria Wolf, the president of the World Affairs Council, introduces the guests and issues stern warnings to protesters in the audience, some of whom did offer their views and were summarily turfed out. First, the weather. It's going to rain most of the day. Highs near 50. Tonight, lows in the 40s. Showers tomorrow. Lows again around 44. And it'll be a bit windy. Chance of rain, 100% tomorrow. And the same goes for most of the weekend. And now, let's hear the clips of the protest at the Schnitzer Theater last night prior to the debate between Howard Dean and Karl Rove. What's it been like? What's the reception been like? How do people respond?
Actually, it's been pretty good. I think these are people kind of interested in this kind of thing. A lot of people have said that they've heard of already Ali Abu Nima from Electronic Intifada. So some people are just kind of put off, I think, by some shouts about the criminality of Karl Rove. My reception for Ali Abu Nima has been good.
And are people listening to you? Have you had any dialogues with people?
One,
have you spoken?
One went through a little testimonial, and she said, "Oh, she knew about him. She said he is awesome." So,
thanks very much.
If you came in the Broadway door this evening, you undoubtedly noticed a number of protesters in the street. You may have also seen picketers outside of the World Affairs Council office for the last couple of days. And you may have written me a letter expressing your outrage about tonight's event. I don't question the importance or the legitimacy of any of these actions. And I consider our friends on the sidewalk, some of which are close friends of mine, to be the loyal opposition. In a nation based on the right to free speech, everyone should have just that, including tonight's speakers. The World Affairs... we're going to have a special rule for this evening. It's two strikes and you're out. One time, we'll excuse you if you sit down and be quiet. You say another word, and we will ask the security people to invite you to leave. This could be used in any number of ways, now that I think about it. We will begin with Mr. Dean.
Thank you very much, and thanks to the World Affairs Council for doing this. This ought to be an interesting night because we're not allowed to talk about domestic policy, but I'm sure we'll come to blows anyway over foreign policy. The truth is, as I look over the past several decades, there's not a huge difference, I think, between a Republican foreign policy and Democratic foreign policy. There are some, and we're going to obviously spend some time talking about those, and the most interesting one I'm going to save towards the end. The fundamental difference, I think, with the exception, of course, of the war in Iraq, which I have to say I don't think a Democratic president would have gotten us into, for better or for worse, and I, of course, think it would have been for better, But the fundamental difference, I think, is really has to do with the influence of the personalities of the president on what turns out to be a fairly steady foreign, what I would argue is a fairly steady foreign policy. Leaving Iraq aside, our policy is really the same in Afghanistan. I supported the war in Afghanistan. I was against the war in Iraq because I didn't think we were being told the truth about why we went to Iraq. But I was for the war in Afghanistan because I believed then, and I believe now, that Afghanistan was harboring a national security threat to the United States and still does. I even support the president's escalation of troops in Afghanistan, not because I think it's a good idea, not because I think it's even necessarily going to be successful, but because I understand, I believe that it's the best of a series of very bad options. So, and we're going to get into that tonight as well, as to why that very, I think he made a very difficult choice, and I think it was the right choice. And I think I'm somewhat encouraged by the fact that he admitted very early on that this war is not going to be won militarily. He understands that, and there's a very limited time that we're going to be there, not because he said so, but because the American people aren't going to put up with this for very long. I want to sort of give a quick world tour. The Bush administration took what I would consider to be a hard rhetorical line on Cuba, Iran, Iraq, and North Korea, the axis of evil and so forth and so on. But the fact is that the Obama administration has used a different rhetorical line, but the results have been the same. I happen to think it was a more clever approach in this sense. President Obama said that he would engage Iran in discussions and was criticized for that during the election campaign. The truth is the Iranian government desperately needs a hostile America in order to help justify their authoritarian rule in Iran. And I don't believe that the only cause of the uprising against the Iranian government was the fact that the president began to remove the United States as one of the quote-unquote obstacles to Iranian progress. But I believe it helped, along with a constellation of other circumstances, to say that he would engage Iran and begin to expose the mullahs for what they were, which is an authoritarian government that wasn't necessarily trying to and would succeed but for the hostility of the United States in bringing a better country. I think the same is true of Cuba. The President Bush took a very hard line in Cuba. President Obama said that we had a 50-year policy that had not been successful, and we ought to look at changing that policy, something that I agreed with. The Cubans, however, have responded in the same way they always respond. In 2004, when I was running for president, I was actually about to say that our policy towards Cuba was a failure. We'd been doing the same thing for 50 years. It hadn't succeeded. The reason I didn't do it was because a day before I was about to announce that we ought to have this change, different policy in Cuba, they incarcerated six people for political, and made them political prisoners. Very hard to make conciliatory gestures towards a regime which does that. Now, obviously, they had no idea I was going to say that. I was running in a primary. I wasn't a factor. But when the President Obama, was sworn in, and had run on a platform of taking a different view of Cuba, what was the response of Raul and Fidel Castro? To crack down more extensively on the Cuban people in order to make it more difficult for President Obama to begin to de-escalate the tension with Cuba. And why? Because the Castros stay in power, in fact, by trying to use the United States as the foil, which justifies their authoritarian regime. I think that President Obama was right in starting a new policy, but it didn't have any effect because, in fact, the Cuban government simply needed to make sure that the United States policy continued the way it had been for 50 years because that was their justification for doing what they do. In Venezuela, I think the Bush administration and the Obama administration have similar policies. This person, his philosophy is one election. I get elected in a democratic election, and it was a democratic election. And the democratic parties in Cuba, in Venezuela, failed to deliver on what they should have, what democracy should deliver for its citizens. So Chavez was elected. That was the last free election in Venezuela. The response of the Bush administration and the Obama administration is to ignore his pronouncements. I think that's extremely important. I think his idea is to provoke the United States into saying things that do us harm in Latin America, and now we force the Latin Americans to have to deal with Chavez, and I think that's a much better way to go about doing these things. I have no way of knowing how the Bush administration would have responded to Honduras, but I think Obama did exactly the right thing. He condemned the coup anew for America, because in fact foreign policy in the past by both Democrats and Republicans have been to say, I don't care how bad this guy is, as long as he is on our side, we'll tolerate him. That is, in my view, a very foolish long-term strategy. And so the president condemned the coup in Honduras. Then he supported the results of the election, which were an open and free election. I think that was a very smart thing to do, and I think it was the right thing to do. So as we go sort of around the world, and in North Korea, I think the policies appear to be exactly the same. We want six-party talks. The Bush people insisted on it. We insist on it. We're going to have debates about this, but I'm struck, as I think about this, by the similarities, with a glaring exception of Iraq. But there are, I think, some fundamental philosophical differences. Carl, we were talking to a small group earlier, and Carl made the point, which I thought was very interesting, that the Democrats tend to be internationalists and the Republicans tend to be American exceptionalists. And I think there's some truth to that. I think that President Obama really does believe in a cooperative approach with other nations, that the days of America dictating to people based on the strength of our economy and our military are over because they're counterproductive, and that in a more mature economic and political world where countries like China have, as they become economically stronger and developed a larger middle class, are in fact becoming more democratic. I certainly wouldn't accuse them of being a democratic country, nor would I commend their human rights record, but certainly their situation 30 years ago was much more dangerous for the world and dangerous for their own people than it is today. And as there's a confluence in nations economically, there becomes a confluence in nations politically, and I think it is a good thing to be more cooperative. But I want to say a word about American exceptionalism, because I think the Republican idea of American exceptionalism and the Democratic idea of American exceptionalism is very different. I think Democrats do believe in American exceptionalism, but not because we have a strong military and a strong economy that gives us somehow the right to do things that other nations don't think are right. I think this is an exceptional country because of the extraordinary hope that is laid out in the founding documents of the United States. I think everybody understands here that President Obama is an extraordinarily popular figure in Europe. Why is that? The Bush administration, in my view, was not terribly respectful to the Europeans. I think the most famous quote is the Secretary of Defense, who said that talked about the old Europe and was condescending and so forth and so on. Europe and the rest of the world, in truth, admires this country because this is a country that does things that they can't do. And I'm not talking about economics, and I'm certainly not talking about human rights, because their record is far better than ours. What I am talking about is a country which fundamentally opposes cynicism. The exceptionalism in America, in our Constitution and our founding documents, is the allegiance to hope and the rejection of cynicism.
Thank you very much, Governor Dean. Mr. Rove.
Well, I'm sorry we're not talking about domestic affairs, because by the end of the evening there'd be blood all over the front stage and Howard and I would be at each other's throats. We're talking about foreign affairs, however.
Okay.
And we're likely to find...
Over there, please. Are you up there? Okay. He's leaving. Good evening, Mr. Rove.
But because we're talking about foreign affairs, we're likely to find more agreement than you might expect. The title of tonight's topic is America's Role in the World, Two Views. I suspect a better title would be America's Role in the World, A View and a Half. Now, let me go through my sort of provocative part of here. And I appreciate your introducer, incidentally. I should thank him for introducing me and for adding a little bit of suggestion that Howard was controversial. In a county that Barack Obama got about 68% of the vote in, I think that was pretty much a stretch. But anyway, that's okay. But let me suggest 10 propositions. The first proposition is that for the future, the United States must accept and understand that it has a unique role of international leadership. If we don't care about it, if we don't lead, the world's not going to pay attention to it. I saw this when the previous President of the United States brought up the issues of AIDS in Africa and the Sudan.
This has been Air Cascadia for Thursday, February 11th, 2010. There's lots more of the two having it out, so to speak. It would have been wonderful if they had really engaged intellectually. Alas, that is not entirely what happened. We'll try to post that for you on the website, though. Today's engineer has been Emily Young. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I am the producer of this show. Liam Delta will be back tomorrow. And stay tuned for Flashpoints right now with Dennis Bernstein coming up. Reports on growing problems with disease and deprivation in Haiti and an interview with financial analyst Catherine Austin Fitz on the second wave of the financial crisis and the rebuilding of community institutions. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your support and have a good day.